Good day to you. This is Kathy Boughton, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am going to be reading from The Week.
And we'll start off with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump shrugs off warnings over trade war costs. What happened? China vowed this week it would never kneel down to America in President Trump's tariff war as shipments of goods from China to the U.S. plummeted, and economists and retailers warned of impending price hikes and empty store shelves. With most Chinese imports facing a 145% levy, essentially all shipments out of China for major retailers and manufacturers have ceased, said Port of Los Angeles Executive Director Eugene Soroka. The chief economist of asset management giant Apollo, Torsten Slok, said he expects empty shelves in U.S. stores in a few weeks and COVID-like shortages for consumers. That slowdown, Slok said, would result in significant layoffs in retail, trucking, and other sectors. Trump signaled his readiness to negotiate substantial tariff cuts and claimed Chinese President Xi Jinping had called him. But officials in Beijing denied negotiations were taking place and struck a defiant tone. Bowing to a bully is like drinking poison to quench thirst, China's foreign ministry declared in a social media video. A report that Amazon would display the cost of Trump's tariffs alongside the price of products prompted fierce blowback from the White House. Trump Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt called it a hostile and political act. The company quickly disavowed any such plan, saying it was under consideration only for its low-cost Hall store and was never approved. Trump said he'd called Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and solved the problem very quickly, praising him as a good guy who did the right thing. Trump signed an executive order easing a 25% tariff on imported parts used by U.S. automakers. Foreign-made autos will remain subject to a 25% tax. Trump called it a short-term allowance for automakers, who say the import duties will spike prices, cut sales, and lead to layoffs. But at a rally in Michigan, Trump vowed to stay the course on tariffs and ultimately slaughter car makers who don't shift production to the U.S. In an ABC News interview, he rejected the idea that American consumers would see any price rises. China probably will eat these tariffs, he said. Everything's going to be just fine. What the editorial said? Economic mayhem is setting in, thanks to Trump's crackpot tariff ideas, said the Houston Chronicle. The stock market has recorded its worst first 100 days of any presidential term since Gerald Ford took office in 1974, with the S&P 500 down 7.9%. Corporations are starting to furlough workers and pause expansion plans. And because tariff costs are ultimately passed along to consumers, not foreign firms, as Trump likes to claim, a typical American family can expect its expenses to climb by $2,700 a year. It won't be the president's billionaire buddies bearing the costs for them. Amazon should have stuck with its brilliant tariff idea, said the Wall Street Journal. Tariffs are taxes, and online shoppers already get to see how much they have to cough up in state taxes when they check out. Americans would benefit greatly from clarity about exactly what Trump's tariffs will cost them. But instead of owning its policy, the White House bullied Amazon to keep quiet. What is Trump afraid of? What the columnist said? Small businesses across the U.S. are reeling, said Daisuke Wakabayashi in the New York Times. Hundreds of owners tell the Times they've been stunned into paralysis by the tariffs and the uncertainty of what's coming next. Tim Fulton, who runs a business in Alaska making conveyor belts for airline cargo, had to raise prices due to new tariffs on essential components that are only made overseas, like motorized rollers from Japan. A pipeline of interested customers then disappeared overnight, and potential investors retreated. Instead of growing his business, Fulton is now consulting a bankruptcy lawyer. Consumers haven't yet felt the sting, but they will soon, said Dominic Pino in the Washington Post. There's a lag because ships from China take a month to cross the Pacific Ocean, and because retailers loaded up on inventory before the tariffs hit. But boatloads of pain will land when retailers run out of product and choose to restock at much higher prices, or decide to let shelves sit empty. Trump's tariffs might steal Christmas, said The Economist. Some 80% of the toys sold here come from China. Production has ground to a halt, and unless import duties are slashed, nearly half the small and medium-sized firms surveyed by the Toy Association say they'll be out of business within months. Trump has taken a phenomenal risk, said Adam Cancrin in Politico. He was elected on promises of lower prices and an economic golden age. Instead, his chaotic tariffs are shaking the foundations of America's financial system and have put his approval rating underwater by double digits. True to form, Trump is blaming stock market woes on former President Joe Biden, said Mark Antonio Wright in National Review, claiming this week it's suffering a Biden overhang. But every American knows Trump owns these tariffs and any economic fallout. We are on the verge of an economic crisis that could leave America poorer for generations, said James Briggs in the Indianapolis Star. It doesn't feel that way now, but recall early 2020 when we knew a lethal novel virus was coming for us and blithely went about our lives. Life felt normal until it didn't. Right now, the vast majority of economic indicators are screaming crisis. The dollar is down, and CEOs say we're heading for a recession. With Trump's next moves uncertain, the future is unwritten, but the risks are coming into focus. Deportations ensnare migrant families, U.S. citizens. What happened? The Trump administration ramped up its deportation campaign this week, defending recent expulsions of American children along with their immigrant parents and arresting a Milwaukee judge accused of obstructing a migrant's arrest. In two separate incidents in Louisiana, women checking in for routine immigration appointments with ICE were arrested and deported to Honduras along with their American citizen children. One of the three children deported, a four-year-old boy, had been undergoing cancer treatment. Lawyers for both families said the mothers weren't given the option to leave their children with relatives in the U.S. There is a strong suspicion that the government just deported a U.S. citizen with no meaningful process, said Louisiana Federal District Court Judge Terry A. Doty, a Trump appointee handling one of the cases. Other deportations separated children from their parents. Tampa resident Heidi Sanchez said she was forced to leave her unweaned baby behind when she was deported to Cuba, while the two-year-old girl in Texas was sent to foster care after her mother was deported to Venezuela and her father to El Salvador's Seco prison. In Wisconsin, a Milwaukee County judge, Hannah Dugan, was cuffed and charged with obstructing federal officers after allegedly directing an immigrant, a defendant in a domestic violence case, to an exit so he could avoid ICE agents. In Maryland, federal judge Paula Zinnes demanded the Trump administration provide an update in the case of Kilmore Abrego Garcia, a Salvadoran who was mistakenly sent to say, quote, "The administration has argued it can't get him back, but President Trump told ABC News this week that in fact he could do so, but will not," saying falsely that Abrego Garcia had MS-13, a gang name, tattooed across his knuckles. What the editorial said? Democrats are seeking to portray the arrest of the Milwaukee judge as part of a Trump administration campaign against the judiciary, said the Wall Street Journal. But ICE agents had a lawful order to detain her defendant, who is here illegally. Rather than comply with ICE, Dugan actually canceled the man's hearing, denying his alleged victims their day in court. Dugan is free to disagree with the administration's immigration policies, but she can't obstruct federal officers seeking to enforce the law. The administration is deporting with such zeal, it's becoming apparent that citizens are being imperiled, said the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Secretary of State Marco Rubio clarified that the American citizen children from Louisiana who were deported may return to the care of a relative who is a citizen. But why the haste to deport in the first place? These local moms may have been present illegally, but they weren't criminals. It appears disturbingly as if Louisiana residents face increased risk of being ensnared in ICE actions, merely because the federal detention centers are located here. What the columnist said? Just why are so many migrants sent to Louisiana anyway? Asked Lila Hlass and Mary Yannick in the New York Times. The reason ICE has 9 centers there, including a giant 7,000-bed staging area, is because the state is notorious for conservative courts, scarce access to legal support, and horrific detention conditions. It's effectively a black hole where migrants can be mistreated and denied their rights. This situation threatens to erode America's rule of law well beyond the immigration legal system. But a backlash is brewing, said Patricia Lopez in Bloomberg. Americans expected deportation of the people they'd been told were stealing jobs and committing crimes, not nursing mothers. Instead, the administration is targeting non-criminals and even legal immigrants with green cards who protested against Israel. Skipping an immigration check-in means ICE can hunt you down and arrest you. Cooperating now yields the same result. It doesn't seem fair. No wonder a majority of voters now disapprove of Trump's handling of deportations. Still, Dugan's arrest suggests the White House won't temper the crackdown, said Adam Sewer in The Atlantic. One need not approve of Dugan's alleged conduct here to understand that the White House is trying to intimidate judges, who so far have not been easily cowed, into doing its bidding. Even activists are being arrested, said Marcela Garcia in the Boston Globe. In Virginia last week, 2 volunteer immigrant advocates merely asked ICE to show a warrant. They are now being threatened with obstruction charges. It's chillingly clear. Judges, lawyers, and ordinary citizens are now potential targets if they dare to interfere with ICE. It wasn't all bad. 34 years ago, magician Sophie Lloyd fooled London's male-only magic circle club into admitting her as Raymond Lloyd. She and her mentor, Jenny Winstanley, concocted the ruse after Lloyd performed in their mime acts as a man. Winstanley trained Lloyd in sleight of hand and helped her create a boyish persona. The club soon let women join, yet expelled Lloyd for deception after she revealed the trick. In April, the Magic Circle gave a show to honor Lloyd and the now-deceased Winstanley and finally presented Lloyd with membership in her real name. A 4-year-old, 28-pound Flemish giant rabbit has become a San Francisco celebrity. Alex the Great was rescued from a kill farm in 2020 and became a certified therapy animal. Outside of work, he drives a children's Mercedes toy car and is lavish with pets and treats. His breakthrough moment came in 2021 when his owner, Josh Rowe, dressed him in a black and orange bow tie for a Giants home game. Fans now call Alex the Rally Rabbit, since the team has won 40 home games with him in the stands. But the rabbit remains down to earth. I can look at him and understand that I don't need to stress out, said Rowe. That's what he does every day. In April, a miniature dachshund's 529-day sojourn on Kangaroo Island, just off South Australia, ended with the help of a wildlife rescue group. Valerie ran off from her owners while they were camping in November 2023, and fearing the worst, they left the island without her. But Valerie was spotted several times since, so Kangala Wildlife Rescue Director Lisa Karen baited herself and an enclosure with a smelly T-shirt belonging to Valerie's owners. Once in the trap, the pup gave up her wild ways and settled into a crate. Kangala confirmed that Valerie is fit and well and is decompressing. Only in America. A Georgia elementary school is under fire after a teacher posted for whites only and for colored only signs above school drinking fountains. In a message to parents, the principal of Honey Creek Elementary said the unnamed teacher posted the Jim Crow era signs as part of a civil rights history lesson, and we do not believe there was any ill intent. Parent Nikisha Wade was unmollified, telling ABC News that the kids are traumatized. A group of eight Republican lawmakers in Minnesota has introduced legislation that would classify some vaccines as weapons of mass destruction. The mRNA Bioweapons Prohibition Act targets messenger RNA treatments, which include most COVID shots, while also imposing a forward-looking ban on any human gene therapy product for any infectious disease. Those convicted of possessing or administering the shots would face up to 20 years in prison. It was a good week for relapsing after Gwyneth Paltrow confessed on her Goop podcast that she has grown a little sick of her restrictive paleo diet and has started eating cheese and carbohydrates again. "There, I said it," added the 52-year-old actress and wellness tycoon. It was a good week for aspiring warfighters after the U.S. Army announced that its fitness test will no longer grade soldiers on how far they can fling a 10-pound medicine ball backward over their heads. The so-called ball yeet became notorious over the years for favoring taller personnel and for testing a skill with limited combat application. It was a good week for reunions after a British man bought a used Honda Civic to replace one stolen in February and found that its trunk had a familiar smell of stale beer and that his home address was already in its GPS. "It was pretty clear at this point that it was my car," said Ewan Valentine, 36. It was a bad week for never forgetting after Navy Secretary John Fallon visited Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, and posted two tributes to the U.S. civilians and service members killed on the fateful day of June 7, 1941. In fact, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor took place on December 7, 1941, what then-President Franklin D. Roosevelt called a date that will live in infamy. It was a bad week for interactive art after a young child visiting a Dutch museum waved a hand and accidentally left several scratch marks on gray, orange, on maroon, number 8, a $50 million Mark Rothko painting. The work has since been removed from display and sent for restoration. It was a bad week for raising the roof after a ceiling panel on a Delta flight from Atlanta to Chicago collapsed during takeoff, forcing passengers to hold it up by hand for about 45 minutes. Passenger Thomas Witchie said attendants eventually scotch-taped the panel back into position. In other news, Congress passes bill to ban online revenge porn. The House this week passed a bipartisan bill that makes it a federal crime to post non-consensual revenge porn online, including AI-generated deepfake nudes of real people. Under the legislation, which passed 409-2, social media platforms are required to remove the imagery within 2 days of it being reported. A version of the bill passed the Senate in February, and President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump both backed the legislation. The Take It Down Act's cross-party backing signals lawmakers' growing anger at platforms for tolerating content harmful to children. The availability of nudification apps has particularly hurt teenage girls, whose male classmates use them to make and share sexual images. "This is one of the first times that we've actually gotten something done on consumer tech issues that is meaningful," said Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat, Minnesota, who co-authored the Senate bill. The U.S. at a glance. Central Islip, New York. Sentence. Disgraced former Representative George Santos, Republican, New York, was sentenced last week to over 7 years in prison, concluding a whirlwind rise and fall that began with his 2022 election and was littered with lies throughout. Santos, 36, pleaded guilty last year to wire fraud and aggravated identity theft for lying about campaign fundraising and stealing from donors. He cried as Judge Joanna Saber read out his 87-month sentence in Central Islip's Federal District Court. Reporters have begun uncovering his many lies about his past, including being a college volleyball star and the descendant of Holocaust survivors, before his congressional term even began, and the House voted to expel him in December 2023. "I cannot rewrite the past," he said in court, "but I can control the road ahead." He appealed to President Trump for a presidential pardon hours later. "Words have consequences," Sabert said. "You got elected with your words, most of which were lies." Las Vegas, friendly pardon. President Trump last week pardoned a former Las Vegas City Council member convicted of using funds honoring a killed police officer for plastic surgery, rent, and her daughter's wedding. Michelle Fiore was convicted of fraud last year and faced up to 140 years in prison. Her outspoken conservatism and pro-gun stance earned her the nickname Lady Trump. She's the latest Trump ally to receive a pardon, and the White House praised her maverick personality. Fiore had raised $70,000 for a campaign to build a statue of Alan Beck, killed in the line of duty in 2014. But none of the money she raised was actually used, and instead was laundered through several front companies. Fiore accused federal prosecutors of weaponizing the legal system against her. Nevada Attorney General Aaron Ford criticized the pardon, saying there should be no room for reprieve when it comes to betraying the families of fallen officers. Oklahoma City, botched raid. Law enforcement agencies conducted a pre-dawn immigration raid last week that stripped a family of their phones, laptop, and life savings, even though all are U.S. citizens. Some 20 officers burst into the house and forced a mother and three daughters outside before they could fully dress. "It was so denigrating," said the mother, who gave her name as Marissa to local news. Though the real suspects had moved away, officers told her it could take months to return her possessions. This week, the Supreme Court heard the case of a similarly bungled 2017 FBI raid, in which a SWAT team knocked down the door of an Atlanta home and held a family at gunpoint. Justice Neil Gorsuch reacted incredulously to the government's claims that officers weren't required to check the address. "How about making sure you're on the right street?" he asked. "Is that asking too much?" Boston, targeting medical journals. A federal prosecutor last week sent letters to medical journalists suggesting they've misled their readers and made insufficient efforts to combat bias. The New England Journal of Medicine and CHEST, which covers pulmonary medicine, were given until May 2nd to respond to the inquiry, which also asked whether they include competing viewpoints and reveal potential conflicts of interest. At least three other publications received similar letters. Dr. Eric Rubin, the editor of the prestigious journal, called the letters vaguely threatening, while an editorial in British medical journal The Lancet went further, calling the probe an obvious ruse and expressed support for medical publishers that are being intimidated by the Trump administration. Critics of the journal have accused it of biased coverage of gender medicine and promoting gender transition for minors. Information published in medical journals is broadly protected by the First Amendment. Washington, D.C. crash investigation. A series of linked failures led to the deadly January crash between an Army helicopter and a passenger jet in Washington, D.C., a New York Times investigation revealed this week. In the worst domestic crash in almost 25 years, a Black Hawk helicopter flew into American Airlines Flight 5342 as it prepared to land at Reagan National Airport on January 29th, killing 67 people. The helicopter crew had been practicing a mission of secretly transporting a senior government official in case of an emergency. Technology that would have let air traffic controllers better track the Black Hawk was turned off, and the crew had asked to navigate by visual separation. Meanwhile, Flight 5342 was headed toward a runway rarely used by commercial jets, which required the helicopter to fly at a lower altitude. About 15 seconds before the crash, the pilot missed a warning from her flight instructor to turn away from the passenger jet. Now we'll look at the world at a glance. Vancouver. Deadly car attack. A man plowed a black Audi SUV into a crowd at a Filipino Heritage Festival in Vancouver last week, killing 11 people, including a child of 5. Dozens more were injured. Witnesses said the vehicle passed a barricade and accelerated into a narrow street packed with people after a concert. The impact sent bodies flying up in the air higher than the food trucks themselves, said Chris Pangilinan, who had a clothing booth at the event. It looked like a bowling ball hitting bowling pins, and all the pins are flying into the air. The suspect, Kaiji Adam Lowe, 30, was arrested and charged with 8 counts of murder. Investigators ruled out terrorism and said Lowe has a history of mental illness. Madrid, unprecedented blackout. Spain and Portugal were hit by a massive power outage this week that affected tens of millions of people. France's southern Basque region was also briefly affected. Trains abruptly stopped, forcing passengers to be rescued by bus. But traffic was snarled everywhere because all the streetlights were out. Restaurants, shops, and supermarkets were suddenly plunged into darkness, and most schools and businesses shut down, although hospitals kept functioning with generators. Mobile phone service was also affected, leaving many stranded people unable to get help. Some stores stayed open for cash transactions only, and long lines formed at the few working ATMs. It's like when I was younger, 50 years ago, said Francisco Garcia, 61, a boat restorer in Lisbon. Authorities in both countries were trying to determine whether the cause of the blackout was sabotage, a cyber attack, mechanical failure, or human error. Paris, grandpa robbers. The men accused of robbing Kim Kardashian in Paris in 2016 finally went on trial this week, and it turns out they're an older gang the French press is calling grandpa robbers. One of them, Eunice Abbas, 72, said the gang had no idea the victim was a famous reality show star. He has since written a book, I Kidnapped Kim Kardashian, confessing to the crime. In what Kardashian calls a terrifying, traumatizing assault, the men burst into her apartment, tied her up with duct tape and zip ties, and made off with all of her jewelry. The robbers left DNA and surveillance video evidence all over, and one of them actually dropped a bag of loot in the street while leaving the scene. Kiev, minerals deal. Ukraine clinched a landmark mineral resources agreement with the U.S. this week, a deal President Trump has insisted on as a condition for further U.S. military aid. Talks had been tense since February, when Trump and Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky were supposed to be celebrating the reaching of the agreement, but instead clashed at the White House over the terms. Zelensky rejected a demand to count the military aid that Ukraine has already received as if it were payment for future mineral mining projects. Under the deal reached this week, Ukraine and the U.S. will establish joint projects to exploit Ukraine's rare earths and other metals, oil, and gas. The U.S. agreed that only forthcoming military assistance would count as payment for resources extracted. It also agreed to a long-term strategic alignment between the two countries and continued support for Ukraine's security, prosperity, reconstruction, and integration into global economic frameworks. Trump's effort to broker peace stalled, though, as Russia continued a wave of punishing airstrikes across Ukraine, killing dozens of civilians. On social media, Trump pleaded in vain with Russian President Vladimir Putin to end the strike, saying, "Vladimir, stop," and he threatened to walk away from negotiations. Trump has criticized Ukraine for rejecting a U.S. proposal to formally cede Crimea to Russia as part of a peace deal. But after speaking with Zelensky at Pope Francis's funeral in Rome, Trump said he was convinced that Putin might be the one who doesn't want to stop the war. Valletta, Malta, stopped selling citizenship. The EU's top court this week ordered Malta to end its golden passport program, saying it reduced citizenship to a mere commercial transaction in violation of EU law. Malta's investor citizenship scheme offers a Maltese passport and the EU citizenship that comes with it for $700,000 after 3 years of residency, or $850,000 after 1 year. The program, introduced in 2013, quickly became a backdoor to EU access for money launderers and other criminals, as well as for Russian oligarchs subject to Western sanctions. The ruling could also spell trouble for EU countries that offer golden visas, including Austria, Cyprus, Greece, Hungary, Ireland, and Portugal. "European passports are not for sale," said Daniel Freund, a German lawmaker of the European Parliament. "Criminals, autocrats, and terrorists should not be able to buy a ticket into the EU." People. French Gates's therapeutic divorce. Melinda French Gates was celebrating her 20th wedding anniversary in 2014 when she suffered her first panic attack, said Decca Aitkenhead in the Sunday Times, UK. While at lunch with her then-husband, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates, she suddenly felt like she was suffocating. The experience led French Gates, now 60, to seek out a therapist. "Then, as I got into the process," she says, "I realized I'd been through some difficult things." That included her relationship with Gates, whom she first met in 1987 after joining Microsoft as a marketing manager. Gates, already a billionaire, asked her out in the company parking lot. The courtship wasn't easy. Gates was fond of partying and strip clubs. They wed in 1994, but things didn't get smoother. Gates was rarely home after the birth of their eldest daughter in 1996. "Okay, maybe he wanted to have kids in theory, but not in reality," she recalls thinking. And turned out to be a notorious womanizer. She filed for divorce in 2021 and experienced panic attacks so bad during the tough negotiations that she had to call her therapist in the middle of the night. French Gates hasn't had an attack since the divorce was finalized and has no regrets about the split. "If you can't live your values inside your most intimate relationship, it's necessary." In the news, Elizabeth Hurley's friends are puzzled by her unlikely new romance with country singer Billy Ray Cyrus, the New York Post reports. The British actress and model, 59, debuted the relationship on Instagram with a series of photos showing her getting cozy with the achy breaky heart singer, 63, at his Nashville estate. The romance has stunned some members of Hurley's circle, including best friend Elton John, who is close to Cyrus's estranged pop star daughter, Miley Cyrus. "Liz's friends think it must be a joke or madness, but they aren't saying it to her," said a source. Not everyone is surprised. Another source said Hurley has been waiting a long time for romance, adding, "I think she likes the whole cowboy thing." NFL Hall of Famer Shannon Sharp announced last week that he will step aside temporarily from his ESPN duties after being hit with a $50 million lawsuit accusing him of rape. The civil complaint was filed in a Las Vegas court by a woman identified only as Jane Doe, who said she was 19 when she met the former Denver Broncos tight end, now 56, at a gym in 2023 and began a rocky consensual relationship. During their nearly 2 years together, the suit claims, Sharp was frequently aggressive and raped her 3 times. He is also accused of recording the two having sex without Doe's knowledge or consent. Sharp denies the allegations, saying he's the target of a shakedown. He said he plans to return to ESPN by the start of NFL season. Bill Maher slammed fellow comedian Larry David for writing a satirical essay comparing the real-time host's recent dinner with President Trump to dining with Adolf Hitler, calling it kind of insulting to the 6 million Jews who died in the Holocaust. David's New York Times essay, which doesn't mention Maher by name, parodies an April 11th real-time monologue in which Maher said he was surprised to find at the meal that Trump was gracious and much more self-aware than he lets on. In his Times article, David gives a first-person account from a Hitler critic who accepts a dinner invite from the Nazi leader and discovered, "We're not that different, after all." Appearing on Piers Morgan's talk show last week, Maher defended his comments, arguing that nobody has been harder on Trump than him. He also said he doesn't want the essay to end his friendship with David. "If I can talk to Trump," he said, "I can talk to Larry David, too." The Alien Enemies Act. President Trump is using a long-dormant law to deport Venezuelans. How does it work? What is the Alien Enemies Act? It's an 18th-century law that allows the president to detain or deport immigrants from countries the U.S. is at war with. In more than 225 years, the law had been invoked just 3 times, always during major conflicts that had been declared wars by Congress, until President Trump triggered it in March against the Venezuelan criminal gang Tren de Aragua. He said the gang, which has spread across the Americas as millions of migrants fled Venezuela in recent years, was perpetrating, attempting, and threatening an invasion or predatory incursion on U.S. soil. Trump has used his authority under the law to deport more than 200 men to a prison camp in El Salvador, but he's facing pushback in the courts as legal scholars argue that the act doesn't apply in the current situation. "We haven't had a declared war," said Georgetown University law professor Steve Laddick. "And no one has tried to argue that that invasion or predatory incursion language could be used in any context other than a conventional war." What powers does it grant? The act allows the president to detain and deport, without a hearing, any immigrant from an enemy nation during wartime. No evidence of disloyalty or criminal behavior is necessary. Along with the Naturalization Act, the Sedition Act, and the Alien Friends Act, it made up the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, which President John Adams signed into law at a time when the U.S. faced the prospect of war with France. "Whenever there shall be a declared war, or any invasion or predatory incursion shall be perpetrated, attempted, or threatened against the U.S., it says, all subjects of the hostile nation or government can be apprehended, restrained, secured, and removed as alien enemies." Why was it created? The point was ostensibly to root out foreign spies and saboteurs. But the Alien and Sedition Acts were also a way for Adams's Federalist Party to target the immigrants who largely supported the opposition Democratic-Republican Party. Many lawmakers denounced the laws as unconstitutional, and Adams himself as a tyrant, to the point where Abigail Adams feared for her husband's safety. When Thomas Jefferson succeeded Adams in 1801, he repealed the other 3 parts of the Alien and Sedition Acts, or let them expire. But the Alien Enemies Act remained on the books. Historian Joseph Ellis called support for the Alien Enemies Act unquestionably the biggest blunder of Adams's presidency. When has it been invoked? President James Madison first used it during the War of 1812 to require all British nationals in the U.S. to register with the government, reporting personal information such as age, address, and whether they'd applied for citizenship. It wasn't until a century later, during World War I, that President Woodrow Wilson used it against German-born male residents, registering 480,000 men and detaining over 6,000. It was last used by President Franklin D. Roosevelt during World War II to intern thousands of Germans and Italians in camps. Most of the 100,000 Japanese Americans interned were held under a different legal basis. None of these events, though, involved large-scale deportations. Is its use constitutional? Yes, during wartime. The Alien Enemies Act first reached the Supreme Court in 1948. In Ludwig v. Watkins, the court rejected an appeal by a German immigrant who'd been ordered to leave the U.S. in 1946. At issue was whether the war had ended by then, which would have meant the law was no longer applicable. Divided on the subject, the court concluded that the definition of wartime was too political for it to answer, and it upheld the deportation. Having survived this legal challenge, the act was largely ignored by the courts and Congress for decades. Yet four justices joined in a key dissent in that 1948 case, arguing that the act denied immigrants due process and constituted an effort to suppress political speech. The notion that the discretion of any officer of government can override due process is foreign to our system, wrote Justice William Douglas. Due process does not perish when war comes. How does Trump justify its use? Trump has repeatedly referred to migration to the U.S., particularly from Latin America, as an invasion, and maintains that the Tren de Aragua gang constitutes an invading army. When asked whether he was in violation of a district judge's order to halt the deportations of Venezuelans to El Salvador, Trump said, "This is a time of war." But only Congress can declare a war, and so far the Supreme Court has limited the deportations without ruling on whether Trump may invoke the act. What has the court said? The Supreme Court ruled unanimously on April 7th that any person in the U.S., even an alien enemy, has the right to fight their deportation in court. 2 weeks later, it issued a rare late-night order pausing deportation of a group of Venezuelans. Now it is up to each individual migrant to plead their case to a judge. But most legal scholars agree that the administration has overreached and the court should do more. Nazis got better treatment under the Alien Enemies Act than has happened here, said U.S. Circuit Court Judge Patricia Millett. Best columns, the United States. Trump's Crypto Corruption, Michael Tanosky, The New Republic. Donald Trump's crypto money-making scheme is the most corrupt thing any president has ever done by a mile, said Michael Tanosky. And unless you follow the news quite closely, it's possible you've not even heard about it. The president announced last week that the top 220 buyers of his $Trump meme coin would get invitations to a private dinner with him at Trump National Golf Club in Maryland on May 22nd. He launched the cryptocurrency just before Inauguration Day to fatten his wallet with tens of millions of dollars from anonymous donors with little to no accountability. His administration has all but eliminated oversight of crypto trading. That convenient bit of deregulation came as the Trump family has earned more than $350 million in crypto sales and fees, and its crypto holdings have an estimated value of nearly $1 billion. And at the $Trump event, will the guest list of influence seekers include convicted criminals, foreign lobbyists, and Russian oligarchs? Past presidential corruption scandals, such as Teapot Dome, involved only subordinates, not the chief executive himself. You'd think the Republicans who were outraged by Hunter Biden's influence peddling scheme might be perturbed by Trump's unspeakably corrupt grift. Instead, crickets. The Anti-Woke Rights Hypocrisy, David French, The New York Times. The anti-woke right never really cared about free speech, said David French. The coalition of podcasters, influencers, and tech moguls rocketed to mainstream prominence in 2020 with a simple message. Cancel culture was real, and Americans need not mindlessly obey government dictates, like COVID restrictions. But as the anti-woke right allied itself with Republican politicians, the movement was divided between a love for liberty and a hatred for the left. Hatred won. In its quest for control, the movement backed Florida Governor Ron DeSantis as he launched a censorious culture war in his state, sharply limiting any discussion of sexuality and racism in schools, and punishing Disney when it dared criticize his policies. In 2024, most of the free thinkers of the anti-woke right backed Donald Trump, the most speech-restrictive authoritarian president in more than a century. Trump has used federal power to punish law firms and universities for their views, ban words like diversity, and censor divisive ideas about America's racial history. The supposed champions of liberty have been largely silent or even cheered Trump on. Clearly, they believe free speech is important only so long as they get to say what they think. Betraying Afghan refugees, Will Selber, The Bulwark. The Trump administration has begun laying the groundwork for a possible mass deportation of the nearly 90,000 Afghans living in the U.S., said Will Selber. If these refugees are sent back to the Taliban, it will be a death sentence. The Department of Homeland Security recently sent emails to Afghan refugees telling them to self-deport. These are people who fled the country when its government fell and were welcomed here under Biden administration programs. As an Afghanistan veteran, I knew many of these people as friends and allies of the U.S. war effort, and we owe them a safe place to live after we abandoned their country to brutal medieval extremists. The Taliban have brought back all of their greatest hits: public executions, floggings, and government-sponsored sexual assaults. Afghans who fled will be prime targets for torture and death if they return. America's military community will be heartsick if Afghans we shed blood to protect are sent back to hellish fates. It will complete America's betrayal of not only its Afghan combat veterans, their families, and millions of Afghan women and children, but our nation's deepest values. So much for making America great. It must be true. I read it in the tabloids. A sexually frustrated, palliated woodpecker in Rockport, Massachusetts, has aggravated residents by smashing the glass on more than 20 vehicles. The breed is very ornery and notoriously territorial, especially during mating season when testosterone levels are high, said biologist Matthew Fuchsjäger. The bird has mostly targeted side mirrors with his aggressive pecking, prompting residents to wrap theirs in plastic bags and towels. Landscaper Mike Foster said the bird cracked the driver's side window of his pickup while staring me right in the eye for a solid 30 seconds. As a result of the widespread vandalism, he said, that woodpecker is looking at 30 years to life. Humanoid robots competed alongside human runners in a half marathon race in Beijing. Operated by teams of engineers and operators, 21 bipedal robots attempted to navigate the 13.1-mile course, separated from human runners by a divider. After crashes, collapses, and other mishaps, only 6 robots made it to the finish line. The winner took 2 hours, 40 minutes, and 42 seconds, including 1 fall and 3 pit stops for battery swaps. The top human finished in 1 hour and 2 minutes. An Austrian company is planning to market a beer brewed from human urine. Oklo, which sells and rents environmentally friendly mobile composting lavatories, will make a lager using urine harvested from the porta potties. Its aim is to publicize treatment methods that turn wastewater into completely odorless and tasteless H2O, said founder Nico Borgelinzaitis. He said advance orders for Oklip Pilsner, as it is punningly called, are already coming in, as is interest from investors. Best Columns International, Canada, an election that was all about Trump. The Liberals just pulled off a comeback for the ages, said Susan Delacourt in the Toronto Star, and they couldn't have done it without Donald Trump. Prime Minister Mark Carney clinched a narrow election victory this week for a Liberal Party that was trailing by 25 points in polls just 3 months ago. Fed up with 10 years of Justin Trudeau, who resigned in January, voters felt seen by Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre, who told them, Canada is broken. But everything changed once Trump returned to the White House, threatening to bankrupt Canada with tariffs and annex it as a U.S. state. Suddenly, even many Conservatives found Poilievre too Trumpy. Carney, a former central banker, looked like a rational adult, a vote for stability amid the chaos Trump keeps wanting to wreak. While Trump seemed to relish his role as spoiler, goading Canadians with an Election Day post urging them to vote for the U.S. leader, Carney responded with sober resolve. President Trump is trying to break us so he can own us, he said in his victory speech. That will never happen. Poilievre was too slow to read the room, said Jamie Sarkonic in the National Post. As Canadians united in newfound patriotism, Poilievre kept railing against Trudeau's hated carbon tax, treating the new hostility of the United States as a secondary concern. But Canadians wanted a protector more than they wanted a tax axer. By the time Poilievre put anti-Trump resistance front and center, it was too late. In the end, he even lost his own parliamentary seat. Poilievre's failure to pivot in time wasn't his only problem, said Brian Miles in Le Devoir. All he'd ever been was a politician. Carney, a Harvard and Oxford-educated economist who has run the central banks of both England and Canada, was simply far more credible and competent. Never before elected to public office, he seems a kind of anti-politician, not slick and overproduced like Poilievre or Trudeau. So the Liberals will cling to power narrowly, said Andrew Coyne in the Globe and Mail. But they can hardly rest easy. The country is more polarized than ever, with the two major parties each taking more than 40% of the vote for the first time since 1930. That means Carney now has to unite a divided nation while confronting the force of chaos next door. He will need to reach out to all those friends in high places he made during his days as a player in global finance, said Alan Woods in the Toronto Star. As Canada begins the complicated, painstaking work of separating its economy from the U.S., it will need new trade partners in Europe and elsewhere. Carney's pre-election whistle-stop tour to Paris and London seems to be paying off, with both France and the U.K. already offering deeper ties. Next, he'll seek access to a European weapons procurement pact as an alternative to reliance on U.S. arms. Carney has been very clear that Canada finds itself in a new world, with its once-trusted neighbor now unpredictable, even hostile. We are over the shock of the American betrayal, he said, but we should never forget the lessons.
And we'll wrap it up with obituaries. The survivor who spoke out against Epstein, Virginia Giuffre, 1983 to 2025. At first, Virginia Giuffre preferred to be known publicly only as Jane Doe 102. Groomed at 16 by Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell to join a sex trafficking ring, she was one of dozens of victims who sued Epstein in 2009. She said the jet-setting millionaire had coerced her into providing massages and sexual services, first to him and then to his rich and influential friends. She escaped in 2002 by marrying a martial arts trainer and for a time lived a quiet life in Australia. But in 2011, after seeing a photo of Epstein out of prison after just 13 months and once again hobnobbing with Prince Andrew, she went public, the first of Epstein's victims to do so, and named her alleged rapists, including the prince. Epstein had her passed around like a platter of fruit, she said, a prostitute for him and his friends who shared his interest in young girls. Raised largely in Palm Beach County, Florida, Virginia Louise Roberts had a dismal childhood, said the New York Times. After being molested at 7, she shuttled between foster homes,
lived on the streets when she was 14, and spent 6 months with a 65-year-old sex trafficker before an FBI raid led to her reunion with her family. Her father was working at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate and got her a job there in the spa. That's where Maxwell recruited her to be a masseuse for Epstein. During her first encounter, the two coaxed her into a sex act and paid her $200. These visits became a daily routine, said the Times UK. Epstein flew her around the world for encounters with his friends, and she was photographed with Prince Andrew when she was 17. The prince denied Jeffrey's allegations, but paid $16 million to settle her 2021 lawsuit. He was later stripped of his royal title. But the pressure of going up against Goliath forces took its toll, said the Miami Herald. Jeffrey separated from her husband, and he filed a restraining order against her in February. The order prevented her from seeing her three teenage children, and her family said the loss of her kids had devastated her. The following month, Jeffrey said on Instagram that a car accident had left her so severely injured that she had 4 days to live, although police labeled the crash minor. Before she died by suicide, she said she and Epstein's other victims continue to find ourselves trapped in a system that overlooks our struggles until it's convenient for those in power. That's all we have time for today.
This is Kathy Broughton, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading the week. Thanks for listening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast/info/audio/on-demand. You can hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.